welcome back to the October edition of the Pally Podcast. It's so great to see you. How's it going this month?
Good. Nice to see you, although I just saw you yesterday, but it's always great to see you, Miriam.
That was virtual. This is real in this beautiful place we've gotten too used to.
Yes, and today is just another wonderful day for us, as you and I were talking recently. We both feel so lucky to be able to do these podcasts, to meet all these interesting, creative, dynamic people who live in our home community, the Palisades. And today is a person who certainly is on that list, deserves to be on that list. It's Ed Massey, who is a local artist who lives in the Omedeo Bluffs. And I found out about Ed because I was walking home from a Pali High football game a few weeks ago and saw this incredible tree that was all lit up with lanterns. I found out they were solar lit, and wanted to find out who did it and searched around and found Ed Massey. And Ed, we're delighted to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Miriam and Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. And of course, being a local Palisadian, it's my first podcast like this, so I'm very excited to be here.
Well, your kids are going to think you're really cool.
That's
if they didn't already.
Do you have kids in the Palisades? Sitting at home?
Well, no. So I have two kids that finally, because of COVID, finally got to go back to school. So they're both in New York. They both go to school at Sarah Lawrence, but they're both Pali, from Pali Elementary to Pali High to Sarah Lawrence. So they're both in New York now.
Yeah, it's really a treat having you here because, as I was telling you earlier, I had actually become familiar with Portraits of Hope through one of my own kids who goes to school in the Palisades, but back then he was in elementary school. And I've learned since then that a whole lot of elementary school classes made that field trip out to, is it El Segundo? To this place that you have. Tell us a little bit. Well, we're going to go back and talk about you and the Palisades, but tell us a little about Portraits of Hope, because in the end it turned out to be a 501c3. That gets involved in a whole lot of projects and really impacts how kids see service. So is that kind of how you envisioned it, or did it evolve in this really great way?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks. I always love when I hear some feedback that someone, either someone that they know or someone actually participated or a neighbor participated in one of our projects, because my brother and I started Portraits of Hope just over 20 years ago. So it's great for us to hear someone that said, hey, you know, we worked on whichever project it is, and we know, because they're usually dated, of whether they're lifeguard towers or we did the New York City taxi fleet. But especially because I'm based in the Palisades and our studio is in the El Segundo area, we do like to recruit a lot of the schools from the local community. And Portraits of Hope began back in 1995, actually, as a creative therapy program, mostly for children in hospitals. So my background's in sculpture and painting and public art, and my brother is in policy-related issues. So we have very different backgrounds, and I have a sister that's also involved as well. But they kind of mushroomed into starting a very small program with it's all volunteer-driven, but just get kids involved in hospitals to see if we can get them involved in projects they would never have access to in the outside world. And then it literally blew up into one of the largest civic and public art programs probably in the world. And I'm really happy to say that we've had over 100,000 participants in 20 years. So it's been really phenomenal for us.
So you mentioned the lifeguard stations, people in LA who wander by the beach, and I'm sure we all do at sometime, saw that you were responsible for repainting how many lifeguard stations?
So we did 31 miles of beach. It was 156 lifeguard towers. And the funny thing, Steve, is that people that are from local communities like the Malibu community would say, oh, we saw that you did the Malibu towers. Or people in Hermosa Beach said, oh, you did the Hermosa Beach towers. But in actuality, if anyone traveled those 31 miles of beach back in summer of 2010, we painted 300,000 square feet of material. So we know how large it was. And the really fun thing about it was called Summer of Color. The really fun thing about doing that particular project is at that time, Zev Yaroslavsky was our supervisor. So we had to get Don Kanabi from the South Bay. And of course, the political process is a little bit to change and transform those iconic gray blue lifeguard towers and coastal commissions and so many cities involved. So the great thing about that was that Benjamin Moore and Vista Paints were our partners to do the paint part. And in one day, we hooked up with the volunteers from Starbucks. We had 1,000 volunteers from Starbucks, UCLA, and a group. It was open to anyone that wanted to participate. If anyone drove that coastline in one, that one day, we first application was painting the rails. All those rails are wood. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't get the kids in the hospitals and schools and social service programs to paint that. So if anyone drove between 9 a.m. and 12 noon on that one day that we painted the rails, every single rail of every tower from San Pedro to the Ventura County line was painted in multiple colors of purple, green, blue, yellow, purple, green, blue, yellow. So people all of a sudden started calling like the city and say, what has happened to our towers? They just transformed in one day. So going out from breakfast to lunch, you'd have seen at least that part, which was really cool for us. So
you know, I think it's quite incredible that you started with, you know, you and your brother and sister with this idea, and it grew to what you're describing right now, where you've got the Coastal Commission and two county supervisors in the city and, you know, county lifeguards and everybody involved. That is similar to some of the other projects you've done where you've had, you know, major organizations kind of coming on board. So I want to start at the beginning because that's huge. You know, I mean, how many people do we know who have an idea or start something small? And it's great and it's wonderful and it has an impact. But what you've done is really pronouncedly bigger. So I just want to go back and, you know, start with maybe just tales of your childhood. What was it like, you and your brother and sister? Obviously, you're close. You're quite different. The one in policy turned out to be able to, you know, merge with you and your arts. There's some synergy there. But, you know, tell us where you grew up and what that was like.
Okay, so I have to speak about my mom because we were really brought up by my single mother. My mother's from Mexico, my father's from France, and they lived originally after meeting in Mexico City. They went to New York, where my sister was born, and then shortly after that, my father really liked Santa Monica, and they lived in Santa Monica and Hollywood for a while before I was born. And then they moved to this small little town village, basically the Pacific Palisades, back in the late 50s. And we grew up just above Marquez Elementary School, actually. Mm-hmm. And growing up there, for those people who remember what the Palisades was like back in the 60s and early 70s, it was quite a different place. Our librarian or the fire person, the fireman was our neighbors at the time. And it was just a small village community. A lot of the neighbors really knew each other. And then the neighbor directly across the street from us had five daughters, actually, who used to babysit my brother, my sister, and myself. It so happened that one of those sisters ended up having a daughter who I ended up marrying. So Palisades, like small. That was my mother and our neighbor, who's the grandmother of my wife, maintained a wonderful friendship even after our families left the Palisades. Both families left the Palisades years later. So it's kind of that, really, that we grew up in the Palisades. I met my wife, though we probably didn't know it at that time when we were 5 or 6 years old, and re-met many years later.
What a great testimony to what we always say, which is that the Palisades is this, you know, sweet community, this, you know, authentically American sweet hometown community. That's really quite the portrait.
You can be the poster child for our podcast with that background.
Was that the Santa Ynez kind of Dulce Ynez streets?
Yeah, we lived on El Oro Lane.
Yeah, of course.
So near Enchanted Way, El Oro Lane. So just beautiful neighborhood. We've passed by the house. I've taken my kids to see our old house. It hasn't changed, fortunately. So it still looks the same as probably when I grew up.
It was probably newly built back then, right?
Probably. Maybe. I don't know if we were the first family, maybe the second family, but it wasn't too old at that point, maybe 10 years at the most. And so we lived in the Palisades, of course, and then our families both parted. And then my mother actually didn't work far from this studio that we're in. There used to be what used to be called the West LA Courthouse.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And she was a Spanish interpreter for many decades until the courthouse went to El Segundo, where she...
What's your mom's name?
Karen Levy.
I know Karen Levy.
Do you?
If you talk to her, I was a public defender, and then I was in private practice as a criminal defense lawyer for my whole career. And I remember Karen Levy.
That's amazing.
Wow. Well, yes. I will tell her, of course.
I think she would remember me.
That's amazing.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, at some point you had to have left the Palisades.
We did leave the Palisades and then ended up in Beverly Hills at that point, and went through the Beverly Hills public school system, but still all my orthodontists and our doctors were still back in the Palisades. So we still had the roots we knew from our swim instructor, and our close friends and my brother's scouts, and my sister went to Paul Revere. I was still young at that time. So we still had our connections in the Palisades. And we never thought we'd move back there. But I just want to say one last thing about my mother, just because she played such a key role for my brother, my sister, and I. So we were brought up by my mother, who was full-time working at that time. And she just retired because of COVID. She was the senior court interpreter for all of LA County, put in, I think, about 50 years as a Spanish interpreter. And so, in fact, I just went to the framer to frame her certificate from LA County. But she would have continued, I think, now getting into her late 80s, but people always tell me that the judges that come over to our house sometimes to visit her would say, you know, they knew my mom and my mom's story. So
yeah, that's amazing. I haven't seen her in probably 15, 20 years, but I remember her well.
I will let her know for sure.
So you then you went to school in Beverly Hills, and then I saw you went to SC, you went to UCLA, you went to Columbia, you went all over the place. Yeah. You got the best of everywhere, it sounds
I made my moves. So again, my mother's work was really as a social worker before going into interpreting. My brother, sister, and I all went into social-related issues, and I thought I was going to become maybe a researcher in sociology and maybe a professor. And then I found my niche in fine art, really, but doing work that was socially critical. And I felt that there was more power in my personal work. My writing wasn't nearly as good as my visual capacity. So I was starting to make sculptural pieces that dealt with social criticism, basically, something that a sociologist may write about and dive into research-wise, and I did it on a visual level. And I felt that the impact visually could be more impactful, potentially, than someone flipping at the time newspaper, print, or magazine articles by having an important subject out in the public. And that was when I did go and do my graduate work at Columbia for fine art. My thesis was very unlike anyone else's. My interest was in basically what the Mexican muralists, which my mom brought me up learning about, was about bringing art out to the public. And for the public that can't afford going to the museums or don't go to the gallery setting or the rarefied space up in a third floor Manhattan gallery, you expose these projects to the general public. And that was my focus of attention.
And you've managed to make a career of it. I mean, it's remarkable because, you know, we all know about the struggling artist who is barely getting by and who can't get their work shown and maybe the most talented person around. But you've managed to put your artwork out in the open and find ways of financing it as well. It's amazing.
It's been a yes. So, yes. And I would encourage anyone listening, if they are interested in the public art realm or they have kids or family members to pursue it, because it's doable. Yeah. If they're passionate, like anything else, it could be anyone in the arts or any field. If they're passionate enough, I'll find those avenues. I get a lot of projects where we get the political approvals and not a dollar to the project yet. Yeah. And we have to hit the ground running. We're saying we're not going to not be able to pursue our goal. So we do it.
And do you like,
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, so going to Columbia, even just that, like getting to a point with your visual art to be able to go to Columbia and then to pursue something as unique as this idea that fine art can be an agent for change or thought, and that it can actually be made available to the everyman. These are really novel ideas that I think, as you say, if there's a kid out there listening to this, or even a non-kid out there listening to this, these would sort of be those ideal goals that people would think, well, I'm never going to get there. I might as well not even try. And what's interesting is that not only have you gotten there, but you have some really thought-provoking art, so sculptural art, that's as you say, without saying a word, sort of makes you think about some of the bigger issues that that impact humanity at the moment.
I'd like to touch base on one of those, if I could, Miriam. Yeah. So when I was at Columbia, I was commissioned to do a project by a consultant that learned of my work. And though it was frowned upon by the graduate program because they didn't want their graduate students getting paid to do work while they were doing their academic work, I was asked to do a project that I had touched upon about called the Corporate Ladder, mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. dealt with ethnic diversity and the corporate structure, gender relations, just the hierarchical differences that the intra competition amongst workers. I did the piece. It was 20 foot tall. It became a very controversial piece, to say the least. In my art program themselves, I almost got kicked out of the program for doing it when they found out it was a commission project. Aside from that, the art professors and visiting lecturers would see and critique the works of the artists, including myself, and always talk about the formal art implications, the aesthetic implications mm-hmm. of my piece, but never talked about the social relevance of
what it was saying.
What it was just saying and what could happen when it was out in corporate America, which it did go just outside of D.C. There was a fury as soon as it was installed. This was a life-size piece. It was commissioned by the principal financial group, a huge privately held insurance company. And immediately everyone from the Wall Street Journal to every Daily, ABC, NBC, all the affiliates started doing commentaries and writing mm-hmm. articles or showing newscasts about this very heated project that showed the depiction of what you wouldn't see visually, but you knew the undercurrents in a corporate structure was. And it had a black executive towards the bottom rungs, a woman in a provocative position stealing a paper from the man's briefcase. And people can see this online if they wanted to see the corporate ladder, but it was removed immediately. It was the last piece in the U.S. that was removed without permission from the actual artist when there was a federal statute that went into effect. So that was my introduction to large-scale public art and the controversy, but also the dynamic qualities that public art can have and that tremendous amount of just reaction that the general person had on the street. So it was a wonderful awakening for me.
I've seen, when I was looking up, our interview subject for the day, I did see that piece. I did not realize that it had been so controversial and had been taken down. We'll post a picture of it, hopefully, so people can see. But I guess it was just too much commentary for people to be able to swallow at the time. I wonder how it would do now in today's world.
Yeah, I would change some of the figures now because you do have some mobility now. The black executive may be up a rung and maybe the woman executive. At the time, there was one of all the publicly held companies, there was one female top executive at the time. It was mainly a white male hierarchical kind of.
Well, certainly that's changing in California for women with a recent law that was passed that mandated a certain number of women be on boards of major corporations. I think it's changing, maybe not as fast as we might like, but
I also think maybe we're better at critiquing ourselves as a society. Maybe we've gotten a little bit more used to looking inward because it's a great piece. I can't believe it was taken down. Again, I wonder if today it would be taken down.
I thought it was a satirical depiction of the corporate ladder at the time. Yeah. And I didn't expect, again, the people that came into my studio in New York at the time, we were talking about completely different aspects. And I didn't really have any political science professors or major, students come in or maybe people in policy related issues or social or to say, hey, Ed, you better be prepared because people are going to hate this piece potentially. And
so I know we're talking about your life and I want to get back to the chronology. Okay. But while we're talking about your visual art, there was another one that jumped out at me. I just want to ask you about it. It's a chess piece, right? It's mm-hmm. a chess table. And on one side is a depiction of a pretty homogenous society, right?
Yeah.
Seems like it. They're all kind of dressed the same. They look the same. They seem to have the same mannerisms. And on the other side, I would argue, is America, right? It's this melting pot, all different kinds of people, different kinds of dress, different customs. People are in all different postures. And as contrasted with the chess pieces on the other side, this kind of looks messy and this looks very regulated. I read what I wanted to read in that. I'm an immigrant, so I read what I wanted to read in that. What did you think when you were making it?
I did that piece back in the early 90s. I think it was completed in 91. It's called Checkmate, but the title is actually in Japanese. And what the project is, or what the piece is a very elegant kind of gilded table, chess table, with the United States lineup on one side versus its opponent, the Japanese, on the other side. So it's almost as if two heads of state were to take the first move. And on one side, you have the Japanese who have declared victory before the first move has been made. They see the American lineup and they're saying checkmate before the first move. And you have all males in the front row. And with the exception of the empress in the queen's position, it's an all-male society, a lineup on the Japanese side. And in stark contrast, you have first of all, on the United States side, you have the president in the king's position, you have the Statue of Liberty in the queen's position, and then you have some of the social, what people would consider some of the social ills of the time back in the early 90s. President Bush Sr. was the president at that time, and his attention is focused directly across the table at the Japanese, not looking internally at the issues related on the American lineup. And I would encourage people that are listening, if they'd like to see it, you can really see it. It has bomb-building scientists. It shows our recidivism rate and the prison rate was greater than any other country. I think Brazil was second at that time. So you show two of the figures in prison. You have a homeless woman taking up three squares. Again, this was done in the early 90s. I could talk about homelessness situation. We all can now. In much greater length than we did then. But it showed a young child at the foot of the Statue of Liberty, that like a teenager that has a child at her side. So it showed like teenage pregnancy. It showed some of the issues that we were facing at that time. And still, that can be considered our greatest strength, is that diversity and the differences that we all have with another. And then again, shortly after that, Japan's bubble burst. It was like the economic giant. It was Japan, Germany, the United States. So that was done back in the early 90s. And the Japanese, that when that was exhibited, Japanese media loved it. They said, finally, here's an American artist that's showing our strength and the problems and the downfall of the United States.
And arguably you were not.
And it turns
where
out
was
that
it shown?
It was the result was the opposite of that.
Yeah. Where was it exhibited?
That was shown through the first. It was shown in Japan in Tokyo, but also in Los Angeles with the city of Los Angeles at the Barnstall Gallery was the first exhibition.
How big is it?
Kind of the figures I think are 10 inches in height, so a little bit larger than a standard chess table. I mean, you would have to stretch across to play your opponent. So it's I don't recall the exact dimensions, but the figures I think are 8 to 10 inches in height.
So I just wanted to read something that I got off your website describing what you do for people who may not still get it. It says that Ed Massey is an American painter, sculptor, and sculptor who creates and or conceives the ideas and concepts for major large-scale public artworks, many of which have visually transformed iconic symbols, settings, and cityscapes. So how do you conceive of these ideas? I know you did, like, for example, you did the tower adjacent to Beverly Hills High School, right, where there's an oil derrick underneath it. I know you did these floating lanterns in which lake was that?
MacArthur Park.
MacArthur Park. You've done things around the world. Do you just sit around and say, let me think about what city I want to transform? How does that work? How's the process start?
That's a fun question.
Or what social ill I want to tackle.
Well, both. I mean, it goes both ways. I mean, there's enough socially related projects that I'm working on right now separately that'll come out in the very near future. But for the large-scale public art projects, for say, like Portraits of Hope, which is really my baby and my brother's as well, is that we wanted to include the community in projects they would never have access to. So in Beverly Hills was our first large-scale Portraits of Hope project. Took about 4 years to get off the ground. Originally, the political process, and I could talk in length, so I'll try not to, but, you know, people laughed at me in the very beginning. They said, you know, you want to get children. It was exclusively children hospitals at that time. So I traveled up and down the state of California. Northern California was a little bit you know, they kind of had a little pushback, like, you know, you're a Southern California artist and you want to do something with our kids at Stanford, at Packard Children's Hospital, or at Kaiser in Sacramento, but the work that the kids do in our hospitals up north are going to come back to beautify LA. It's like, no way. So I went through some of that in the beginning. But for instance, in Beverly Hills, back to your question, Steve, is that there was a there was a building that was falling apart, which was an old oil tower. I'm not in the oil business. I could care less about oil as long as it doesn't, you know, hurt our environment so much. But the building itself was in the heart of the city. It was on one of the major thoroughfares in Los Angeles.
It's highly visible. Everybody sees it.
Right. It's as tall as the Statue of Liberty. It was on Olympic Boulevard. And the city basically let it fall apart. It just aesthetically, it was a monolith that was just in horrible shape. So I, on my own, went and started taking millions of photographs of it, showing the deterioration, the holes, and try to convince the city leaders, look, allow me to get the graduate art programs at CalArts, at Art Center, UCLA, USC, Long Beach State, some of the local ones here, to scaffold it and paint it. And I met with the engineers and they said, you can't scaffold this building. It was painted originally on the ground in Orange County 17 years prior. And I said, okay, and didn't think much of it. Went for a run on the high school track there just for some exercise. And shortly after, I looked at it again. I said, geez, if this was painted directly on the ground for that tower, then we can include anyone. And I'd just finished my children's book. My first children's book was invited to a pediatric care hospital in Orange County at Chalk. Went to the playroom, read my book, saw the kids were painting on small sheets of paper like any other child would at a school. Didn't click yet, but shortly after that, I thought, goodness, if this tower in Beverly Hills is falling apart, there's no windows on it, and it was painted on the ground, potentially we can reconsider it as a community as the first removable building of its kind in a metropolitan area. No windows, you don't have to worry about plaster, steel, concrete. It's pliable material. We'll take the new material, paint it on the ground with children in hospitals who are already drawing and painting, give them access to something they could never reach at 170 feet in height, and see if we can get the whole state of California to participate in pediatric care units, burn trauma, orthopedic, HIV units, heart units, you name it, we would go in. That was my goal. I got everyone to sign on. I got the senators to sign on, both it was Feinstein and Boxer. Oh, no, it was Governor Gray Davis, actually, at that time. Sorry, I'm dating it. And I got all the mayor involved. I got all the architecture, LACMA, MOCA, all the directors to say, here's an opportunity. It doesn't cost anyone anything. Only those who want to partake in it will be able to help fund the project. We'll do it by volunteers. But let's see if we can get the kids involved. And that was kind of the beginning and marriage of Portraits of Hope. Children involved from all the hospitals in the state of California, from Eureka to Children's San Diego, participated. We had about 4,000 kids, and we had about 15,000 children in schools actually do the primer coat. So healthy kids were doing the primer for the kids in the hospital, and we went into bedside units and took the smallest panels directly to those children.
Amazing.
And they painted. I designed shoe brushes, mouth brushes, telescope paint brushes, so any child who wanted to work could. And that was the beginning of Portraits of Hope.
Wow. And so for people that are listening and may be curious, who funds all these things? I mean, maybe you can't paint it all with the same brush. Who funds this may not be the same type of organization that would fund your other projects. But, you know, you're living in the Palisades. You're surviving. You look healthy. You're eating. How are all these projects funded, and how do you make a living doing this?
Well, so I have to sell my regular body of work to support my nonprofit work, number one. But okay. My brother and I, since we weren't really in the nonprofit world, even though we are a nonprofit organization, neither of us like fundraising. We don't like that. We've never had in 20 some odd years. Either we're really stupid or we're just different. We never had a fundraising event, never had like a dinner function. We don't accept and never have accepted government funds. So we're kind of tied our hands behind our back to begin with. So the way we thought people should get involved in this Portraits of Hope program is those who want to. Mm-hmm. So we ask. I get on the phone with everybody. So now that Steve, I have your number. Miriam, I don't have your phone number. You better watch out. Next time Ed Massey calls, I'm just going to go to voicemail because I don't want to know what he needs this time. But we ask a lot of people for a lot of things. But we do get corporations involved. And we get everything from free rent in studio spaces to all our materials. I mean, we always need the cash dollars too, but there are foundation. And we don't have the time usually to apply for the grant process because when we get a political approval, it's usually hit the ground running. So, for instance, we did the transformation of the New York City taxis. And you were asking earlier, Steve, how do you come up with these ideas? After we did the Tower of Hope in Beverly Hills, I went to New York and had seen that all the walls pretty much had these big graphics already. I was like, God, we can't do a big wall, even though I'd like to, because they've already done. And as I was crossing the street, I was sipping a coffee. I was crossing the street, I'll never forget, a sea of taxis went right by me. I was like, oh my goodness, here's our next project. Here's a mobile canvas, the yellow iconic taxi. And sure enough, went, took meetings with the Giuliani administration. They were like slow off the blocks. They didn't like the idea necessarily. I said, look, we would move our operation to New York. We would work with the New York community, kids, thousands of them would participate. We would transform the yellow cab. And then I kept pushing. Every year I set meetings. Then the Bloomberg administration came on. And it's like, and people know this about me. You say no to me or my brother, we will hound you for 30 years. We will try to get you to say yes at some point because it makes sense. It just, it's like you have a yellow taxi and the Bloomberg administration finally gave in. And it took 7 years to get that project off the ground. But they said, okay, enough with these guys, I think. Let's give them the approval. Same thing happened in Beverly Hills. It's like, we don't know if kids' paints will work on this big iconic structure in the city, but let's, what do we have to lose? You know, they're paying for it. And we have a removal process that if it doesn't look the way it does in it, within a short term, we will take the responsibility to remove it. So we ended up getting the fleet of New York taxis. We had 5,000 taxis.
Wow.
900,000 square feet of paint surface, 20,000 participants, and everything was given to us to do.
And so, Miriam, you don't know this. You were talking about putting something up on the site about his sculpture, Checkmate. Mm-hmm. Before you got here, I took a picture of Ed out in the parking lot. He is driving a New York City taxi cab.
You're
for his
kidding.
Regular vehicle. It's painted, and it looks beautiful. And
we will post that picture as well.
For sure.
And I have to say, it's kind of interesting that it was the Bloomberg administration that made this happen while the Giuliani administration kind of just couldn't see the value and dragged its feet.
It was the beginning of Giuliani's downfall.
Yes. Yeah, just interesting. Not to
long,
make
steady downfall.
Okay. Two questions. Yeah. What street were you crossing with your coffee when you saw the fleet of taxis? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was right across Lincoln Center. So it was between Broadway and Columbus, and there was like a little triangle, and that's where the cars like crisscross in every direction. And I was like sitting on that island with my coffee, and that was it. And that's why the ideas sometimes are some of my favorite parts, like the Tower of Hope. It's because I went for a run. I saw the structure, you know, the New York taxis. I was invited to Chelsea Piers in New York after, and they said, Ed, you know, can you do a Portraits of Hope project? And I said, sure. And I looked at the walls there and we said, okay, we could do it. And I was like, gosh, Chelsea Piers, for those people who know Chelsea Piers, you're right on the Hudson.
Yeah.
I go, how can you do Chelsea Piers with kids and not do a boat? I said, I want a boat. And sure enough, they had a relationship with a historic tugboat from called a Hackensack World War
Amazing.
II tugboat. So we got the tugboat. So the kids painted the tugboat. And then we did a I just want to, if I could just say one more project that
is
yeah,
much
but
as
I
you
want
like.
You to tell us how you painted the taxis. I'm just wondering what kind of panels, so, I mean, how'd you get that paint on there?
So, and let me tell you, these are, again, for anyone, hopefully can be inspired to do this. And I've heard from people who said, you know, we've started our own little community project and it's grown. We love it because there's too many gray spaces and empty walls in this world, in my opinion. And there's too many alleyways that could just use some beautification. It doesn't take a lot to do, really, if someone wants to start small. And if they want to expand, it's just how much, you know, oomph they have. Yeah. Do they really want to go after these? And, you know, I think, Steve, I told you I'm losing the hair on the top of my head. It's because I want to pull whatever's left out sometimes because there's a process. But
That's my excuse, too, by the way.
Well, I'm there with you. So anyway, with New York Taxi, so again, once we got these approvals, the Bloomberg administration held a huge press conference at City Hall, and it was beautiful. And it's like, basically, we have 1 year to do the project. Now, for any sane person, it's like, you have almost 1 million square feet to paint with children and adults. You don't have a dollar. Because the way we fundraise is once we get an approval, we start asking people. So we're like, okay, we're at $0. It's 900,000 square feet. We've done all the testing already. We got Caltech professors. We got everyone to test it prior. So we knew how to do the project, but we needed the funding. We needed the resources. We needed space in New York. We're coming from LA and so forth. So it all materialized, but we start getting on the horn. My brother and I, again, we're a small operation that expands exponentially because it's usually just a handful of people. Everyone has side jobs pretty much for Porches of Hope. So anyone listening, if you think you're too busy, come join us on a weekend because it's all literally volunteer driven. But we started asking companies, and we got a company that did a previous project to supply the material. We work with big, huge manufacturing companies, and we were kind of the testing ground. So sometimes it could be a company like MacTac that some people in the industry know for adhesive vinyls or 3M or Avery products. And we say, look, we're going to test it out. We're going to step on your material. We're going to have wheelchairs roll over it. You can promote your materials. Then we're going to hand paint it, which is different application than printing. And then we're going to apply it to an iconic global kind of image that millions will see. So let us have your material, basically. So we get paints donated and materials donated, and we got the Hotel Pennsylvania through Vornado Realty to donate this 20,000 square foot grand ballroom where Count Basie Orchestra and all these jazz legends perform. So people came on board. And then
really incredible.
We had to bring in NASCAR and Formula One installers who do this type of installation because the kids paint on adhesive vinyl. So we use acrylic paints. They paint on adhesive vinyl. And then these Formula One NASCAR people came from all over the country because there's a very limited group of people in the world probably who do this type of profession. And they came in. We had to put them up in motels. But for about 3 weeks, they did the hand application. And then because New York was so difficult, because we're a volunteer program, and the mayor said, you have access to the New York taxis, but we don't want to enforce it. It's up to each individual owner. And it's a whole, oh my goodness, it's a puzzle to say the least. But we had to convince separate owners, fleet owners, independent owners, then the drivers. We had people that spoke, I think we had 20 different language interpreters to speak to the drivers, because we had to encourage the drivers, look, you're doing a good service. It's a four-month exhibition. Mm-hmm. Those pink flowers that child painted at Mount Sinai Hospital, you get to be kind of that platform. It's kind of that museum on wheels. And you get to showcase. All the kids sign their names to their panels.
Amazing.
It was a beautiful project, but it took a few good years to do. So that's why I proudly drive my New York cab here in the Palisades.
Yeah.
These are huge projects, though. I mean, you talk about them, you kind of rattle them off like it was, something you did or done or, accomplished. But these are huge projects. I mean, 5,000 taxis in New York City with all those different operators, all those kids, the paint, the vinyl, the application. It's huge.
Yeah. It's amazing. Do you ever sell your artwork?
Yeah. So and that's
is that how you finance all
yeah,
this?
Yeah, that's how I finance. That's how I can do what I do, basically, because I put huge amounts of time into Porches of Hope. We're very hands-on, to say the least. I mean, I've visited every single hospital in the country and in Mexico and in Japan that we were involved in that I can think of, from Walter Reed Army Medical Center to the smallest hospital out in Eureka, St. John's, I think, or St. Joseph's. So we're hands-on. Mm-hmm. So the way and the only way that I'm able to do this, again, because we fund each project independently, is that I have to sell my work. So there's a lot of, thankfully, there are collectors who not only buy my paintings and sculptures, but that I think they know, and I'll speak to them, especially if I meet them, that by supporting my painting or sculpture, you're supporting my nonprofit, yeah, or Porch of Hope. So they get involved, even if it's a peripheral way to do it. Mm-hmm. I think they know that the big projects
they're buying
that I
into
do.
Something
right.
bigger. Yeah.
Right.
So, and it sounds like you operate pretty lean until you have a project, and then you kind of just hit the ground and raise funds. And the story that you weave, like the narrative that you lay out, is pretty compelling. You know, I think when you call people, if they're already supporters of your art, I think, you probably already have them halfway in. But when you call someone and say, hey, I'm involving children, I'm doing something great, I'm addressing, some iconic, visual or even a social ill, it just sounds like you sort of get these people to join a cause. It's more than just donating to an artwork. It's joining a cause.
It's true. I'll say this. And when I say that, we have kind of that stick-to-itiveness, and my brother, too, is that we get a lot of rejections. And I try to explain, tomorrow I'm speaking at UCLA to students, and part of my mission, I think, is, look, you're going to get so many no's. I mean, people that I know in the theater world, in the singing world, music world, I mean, there's so many no's in those worlds, right? It could be in any profession. But because I'm on the visual arts side, I know about those no's. I get them. Even at this level, there's people who are hesitant. But at the same token, I think our portfolio is big enough that I get a lot of yeses to at least listen. We have a very big proposal right now for Washington, D.C. It's at the hopefully going to be at the highest level soon. It deals with renewable energy. What you saw that testing at the tree. We could talk about that now. But so we do get the hesitance, like, you know, what do they want from us? And, you know, but when people, I think, especially elected officials, realize that we're going to be doing a positive community-based project at no expense to any school, any hospital, any facility. We don't accept those government funds, so we're not tapping into the resources that are already so stretched thin, not cultural affairs dollars, not city dollars. We will fund each project. And we're batting right now 1,000, which is amazing because there hasn't been a project that we've gotten that we couldn't fund. And it's like I said, there's sleepless nights for us. We knock on a lot of doors. We need a lot of materials. We need studio spaces. I'm on the phones right now currently because we need a new studio space and a warehouse space. And people have been receptive. I mean, people have been they could easily say no to me. It's so easy to say no, right? It's not for us. It takes a little bit more courage, I think, to say yes and see if those projects can really culminate to what they do. And and fortunately, we have a good record. The city of LA, I would say from my own biases, looks a lot prettier after those short exhibitions in MacArthur Park or the LA Convention Center.
And didn't you tell me, as I recall, and I could be wrong, that the lanterns hanging in your tree are a test to see whether you can use those lanterns in some other larger project? Is that right?
That's 100% correct. So
Tell us about it.
If anyone drives by those El Medio bluffs, even from probably a great distance, we've had people see them from the other bluffs.
You can see it from the high school football field.
The high school, sure. Right. So if you go visit another football game, anyone going to a football game, they can definitely just look up and you'll see the one lit tree is our tree. So those all renewable energy. So because of climate change, it became such an important part of Portraits of Hope. Bernie leads the education. My brother Bernie leads the education. I lead the hospital facility side. So we split our talents in that way. But climate change is the most pressing issue, I would say, for everyone on a global level. I mean,
should be.
It's going to be what I think it's either going to make or break our planet and for all those future generations. Because we did the spheres at MacArthur Park and we did a project at the Beverly Hills Lily Pond, there was something missing at nighttime for our viewership. We had hundreds of thousands, if not millions of viewers see MacArthur Park in the daytime. But at nighttime, people would go and there'd be residual city light. And I said, you know, we're losing our viewership. It's a public project and I want it accessible 24 hours a day. And if that metro driver wants to look out and see something beautiful or someone passing by at 3 a.m, they should. And the convention center was lit with solar. So I wanted to light our spheres and we couldn't do it, but on this project called Tubes and Cubes, we have these cylinders and cube-shaped designs that children and adults will be painting. We use renewable energy. Each one has a solar light attached to it. And the tree is part two. Part one is actually that they can float in water. So, Steve, I think that's what you're mentioning is that, so what we're going to do is MacArthur Park, we just got the approvals we haven't even announced that this will be the first announcement today on the podcast.
We're always trendsetters.
We did have another really important announcement a few years ago. I'll remind you. Okay, tell us.
So this may be the second one. But we're good with seconds. So City of LA granted us the permit, and we will have a community Portraits of Hope project where we'll have thousands of children and adults painting the materials that will encase these tubes and cubes and illuminate MacArthur Park. In daytime, you will see magnificent, vibrant colors painted by community. And at nighttime, as soon as the sun goes down, from dusk to dawn, we will see the reflective qualities of MacArthur Park lighting up at night, because we'll have about 1,000 of these tubes and cubes floating in the water. Now, that's the great part. But because of the climate change and renewable energy, we want to expand it to the East Coast. And we think that the Biden administration is the perfect fit right now. So without getting into too many details, we're
the
trying to get
the
DC. Well, maybe. No, it was definitely on the Eastern Seaboard. Okay. We want to do something, so we'll have the West Coast with MacArthur Park. But we are in the midst of right now speaking at a good level to see if we can do something to incorporate all 50 states in a very high visible waterborne project on these.
That is amazing.
So I'll let everyone's imagination kind of like, what are they thinking?
Wow.
And I do think, the Biden administration is certainly the one to listen to something like this. You know, this is that moment where a Democratic administration would have ears for something like this. Good luck. Good luck with it.
So does your brain ever explode with all these ideas that it must be constantly popping into your head about these incredible ideas? How are you going to get them done? Do you have enough time? Do you have enough wherewithal to do all these things?
That's, a very good question, because it is my greatest gift and my detriment, unfortunately. And I try to tell that to my kids. I said, we are a small operation that expands to the largest. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think they are the largest civic and public art projects probably in the world. We bring in thousands of people into a project. But in between there, in that downtime, I'm always thinking of that next thing. Mm-hmm. And I also do a lot of experimenting, and I have patents going on with projects. So I'm always, my mind does think about what can be done next and how to improve on the next project and what needs to get done and what city could use some color and what can I implement to, I'm working on a device right now for people in wheelchairs or seated positions that can't get, I've designed a telescope paintbrush that works for the seated position, but I thought some of the participants can't even bear the weight of a light paintbrush. So I'm doing something with ball bearings right now that actually takes the weight off of the participant in a seated position that can get them actively participating in the painting activity to get their physical motion moving, but with the use of ball bearings. So I'm designing that right now, but I have 16 other things I have to do at the same time. So I'd like a few other helpers to work with me on sometimes, and I pull, but I love it. It's the part that I love the most. Sometimes the execution could be labor intensive, because it could take years to get off the ground. But the concept, the idea, and keep me moving. As long as I'm relevant, I tell this to my kids. As long as I see a teenager that says, wow, that's so cool. Or like Steve, you said you saw the lights and, hey, that's really cool. Yeah. Then I feel like there's this relevance for me. As long as those young generations also in particular mm-hmm. like to be actively participating in our projects, because we get the middle schoolers, the high schoolers, Miriam, like your son,
elementary
right?
Elementary
school. As long as they're enjoying it and they see the aftermath of, hey, look at that blimp that was just painted with my brushstrokes, or that airplane or tugboat or fire trucks, right? We did fire trucks. It's prohibited by law. These are first responding vehicles that we had access to in Aspen and Snowmass. You know, to see paramedics, and I know I spoke to one of the paramedics later. They said the person got in the first person they picked up in a flower paramedic thought they were hallucinating when they were picked up because they
coming
had
coming off the mountain probably
these vibrant flowers. It wasn't
that's
the
crazy.
So
I think it's interesting that your mind must go very quickly, right? Like, 100 miles an hour, you're thinking of new projects. You've got a couple of things going on. You're working proactively on this or that or the other, but the actual project takes years to implement. So it's kind of it's definitely fast paced, but once you get approval for something, and as you say, you're always kind of involved with elected people, you're involved with policy issues, you're involved with all the red tape that goes into public projects, they kind of evolve probably more slowly than your natural pace of developing ideas and getting them done.
Just one thing to add to that. So because of COVID, I was working a lot from home, mm-hmm. and my daughter, Georgie, and my son, Felix, would walk by and go, Dad, you never work. You're always staring. You just look outside. I go, this mind's not stopping, my dear. It's like I'm considered a very slow worker. Like when I paint, it's methodical. When I sculpt, it's methodical. But the concepts and the movement in my head sometimes, it's very fast paced. No one sees it, but I know it. But the next projects are all like, I'll stare at the window and my daughter thinks, God, dad is like just getting, you know, to the point in life where he's looking at the birds for pastime.
And but they have no idea what's going on in your mind.
I go, you don't know. I won't say it here, but I joke with them a lot that just, you know, people at that type, like, cause they're very creative. They're probably more creative than I am. And that's not a joke. In their fields of art that they've both taken, my wife too, in music. But I say, look, there's a level that you just won't understand, kids. Just jokingly about the creative process. I'm just teasing with them because I look idle. Half my life, I think it looks like I'm just not doing anything, but it's not really accurate.
That's crazy. What a great story. I want to talk about homelessness because I think you're doing something with tents, right?
Yes.
And not to go without mentioning in LA how much you impacted animal shelters, which must have been a thrill for the kids that worked on them.
Yeah. So let me talk about the animal shelters first. We did animal welfare. Animal welfare became one of the critical issues in our education component for the children in the Portraits of Hope program. And we said, you know, we work with so many communities, and animal welfare becomes, for these children and adults, one of their key subject matters that they want to focus on in later years. Mm-hmm. We have to do something with the animal welfare, and what can we do? So LA County has the largest welfare shelter system, yes, the animal shelter in the country. So they process more animals than anywhere else. Often they get a bad rap. And if anyone has ever visited one of the LA County shelters, you wouldn't almost know it existed. You could pass by. It looks like a government building. And we're like, we need to do better. We need to make sure what Porches of Hope can do is add a lot of cheer, vibrancy, color, and fun and love back to a structure. So we got the approvals. Supervisor Sheila Kuhl was instrumental in giving us the green light. That was in 2015, a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But they're still up. Mm-hmm. So we did a redesign of all the shelters, including the cats. We got Kit Kat Clock, if you remember the iconic Kit Kat Clocks, those clocks. We got Kit Kat Clock to come on board and give us, we did this beautiful installation in all the cat shelter areas where we put the kids' paintings behind these Kit Kat Clocks. So it just became amazing. A festive, beautiful areas and all the exteriors as well. And so, and we heard back from LA County that many more visitors started to come in to Incredible. The shelters and adopt these furry pets.
So it made a difference. It actually had an impact practically in the outcome of you know,
they
for
did
the
statistics.
Animals.
Yes, they Amazing. Did their statistical numbers and the numbers increased.
So it, even though the function of the shelters was exactly the same, the fact that it was a more attractive place to go increased the number of people that were going to it.
They did. And as much as what I think happens also, someone may come to the shelter and rescue that beautiful pet, their new pet, but it's not something that unless you want to feel good about that place you're entering, like any cafe or something, if there's a good ambiance, you may just tell your friends, hey, you got to come check out the new shelters and adopt that bunny or cat or dog or horse, whatever.
So, I mean, a nod to your mom for instilling in you and apparently your brother and sister this sense of service, maybe, or an awareness at least of the world around you or the issues around you. I love it. I mean, you know, you're doing it's obviously your calling. You're creative. You see issues. You are able to address them in a way that resonates with people. But you're addressing some social ills that really are productive. And before we let you go, homelessness across Los Angeles is a huge issue. I know you talked about the fact that it made it onto your chess piece sculpture. What are you doing with tents, or what can you? How much will the city allow you to do with these tents?
Well, it would be private, number one. And it wouldn't be... we wouldn't need the permits to do that because we would distribute tents to men and women who were unsheltered who needed a tent, number one. So if they had a broken tent, we would provide new tents. But the whole thing is that I've been tackling the issue as many people. I've been doing it for about 20 some odd years. I think I've done about 4 or 5 projects that deal with the unsheltered communities. At the time, we would just use homeless men and women, and you would see them in isolated areas, mainly like in the LA area, like you'd go to downtown and see them. Mm-hmm. And then in Santa Monica, you'd see them. But of course, it becomes one of the topics other than climate change, I think homelessness, especially in the county of LA, is probably the number one issue, current issue. And it's also the first social issue so many children see as growing up. Mom, dad, why is that person urinating outside? Why are they on a park bench? Why are they eating from the garbage that we just threw something out? And like, what's going on? So it's something that we've seen for decades. And it's not one administration. It's been the inherited from one administration to the next. It's kind of like we throw up our hands with desperation. We know the homeless are there, but what can we do? It's too big of an issue. And there's another piece right now in Santa Monica and 26 and Wilshire. That's a current piece called In the Image that's up right now. So if anyone drives on the corner of 26 and Wilshire by the New Balance store, they'll see my sculpture called In the Image. It's about a homeless man I did 20 years ago, but it's on exhibit now. It's been for 2 years. But the tents are basically saying, look, if we're going to live with homeless men and women in our community, and we're not agitated as a community enough, I mean, we're hearing more dialogue now, of course, but if the general public doesn't get agitated, and if we don't allow developers to go vertical and allow more affordable housing and all the, you know, the medical attention that's needed, and if we don't get involved right now, the homeless men and women that you may not see day to day are going to have no choice but to come into every neighborhood, including Santa Monica, Santa Monica, of course, but the Palisades and into Malibu and any region for the West LA people, that if I'm going to have a person that's unsheltered on the street, I, as a neighbor, want to see a more beautiful tent. So it's somewhat a mockery, again, by making these very designer-like tents for men and women. Now, I've spoken to a lot of homeless men and women who said they would love to have a new tent and one that was colorful and something that they would take care of more. But that's not its intent. I don't want to see men and women out on pavement. Yeah. I want them in real shelter, as most people, I think, would agree. We have to get something done now. We need the general public to get agitated. Yeah. And I think
this is your way of raising that profile and making it noticeable and making people take a look and take notice of the fact that there are these tents and they can't be here.
And they're ludicrous. It's like, who needs, I don't want to do this project. I don't want to see men and women on the streets. But if they are, then you know what? Let's have very beautiful tents for us, the general public, to look at when we look out our streets.
Wow.
Amazing. You'll create a story around it. You'll create a narrative around it. It'll get attention and it'll get people to have to look up and notice that there are homeless people in every neighborhood, as you say, and there's got to be solutions better than tents. Well, it truly has been a pleasure to have you. Really, I feel like we could have you for a few more hours of conversation. There's so much that you do. There's so many and so many issues you impact. There are so many issues you take up with your art, whether it's Portraits of Hope or with your sculpture. It really is a pleasure to meet you. I'm glad everyone will know that you're in the Palisades and they'll know that every once in a while you need a hand. You'll have a big lift and you need a lot of people to just come in and help. So hopefully everyone's going to do that. The website is portraitsofhope.org, right? Everybody log on, click over, take a look at the work. It's incredible. And Ed Massey's profile is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's as I said at the beginning, I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to meet so many great people, including yourself. And it was just fortuitous the way I happened to see the tree. And little did I know that I'd seen your art all around Los Angeles on the tower on Olympic and the beach lifeguard stations. And it's just great to see a really creative person with a good heart trying to make this world a better place. And you are certainly the epitome of that. So thanks for joining us, Ed.
I'm very grateful, Miriam, Steve. Thank you for having me today.